Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, and I'm going to put my guest back on. For some reason, we lost somebody. Okay, Donald, you're there, right? Okay, for some
reason. Yes, I sure am. Hi, Fran.
Yeah, I know, it logged out for some reason. Okay, people, this is Fran Lewis, and it is gorgeous outside. It's beautiful. But get your sneakers on. Get your poodle skirts on. Put those old vinyl records on from the 50s and the 60s. And let's hear what Donald Riggio has to say about Beyond Vinyl. The rock and roll saga continues. And let me tell you something. This book is going to bring it all back. This is one of my favorite books, one of my favorite time periods, and one of the few times that you can actually understand the words when people sing. This is
true.
When people actually knew how to sing. So, hi, Donald. Welcome. How you doing?
I'm fine, Fran. I'm happy to talk to you and want to thank you for letting me speak to your radio audience.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm so glad that you're here, and I'm so glad that the phones are working. Oh, my goodness. It's like crazy out here. So, what made you decide to do this particular time period?
Well, I've always been a fan of rock and roll music. I'm a child of the Beatle era. I was 14 years old when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, and like all boys that age, once we saw the Beatles, we had to go out and learn how to play guitar and try to sing and form a band and become rich and famous rock stars. But our little group that we had, that we put together, a little garage band, one of the members of the band, a friend of mine, had an older sister, and she was an Elvis Presley fan, and she was a Fats Domino fan of that period, just prior to the Beatles. So we listened to a lot of her records, and we added a lot of those songs and a lot of those artists to our repertoire, and that gave us a little foot up on all the other local bands who were just doing Beatles and British Invasion stuff. And the more I learned about the blues and R&B music, the more interested I got. And then over the years, certainly as the dream of becoming a rock star faded and reality set in and life took its charge, I always stayed a fan of the music through all the years. Went to as many rock and roll shows as I could, the Murray the K shows down at the Brooklyn Fox Theater, the Brooklyn Paramount, the New York Paramount, all those shows, and just stayed with it and went to every concert that I could, you know, throughout the years. And when I decided to try to do something to put my little contribution to keep the music alive as the years went by, I decided to try a novel. I've always had the writing bug in me, and I decided I'd try a novel that had to do with rock and roll music. And that's how the first book, 7-Inch Vinyl, came about.
Well, I'm glad that you said that I read it. I think I saw it on Facebook, and then you put it out there, and then I asked to read it. It was really good. And this one is really good. So for those of you that think it's just about music, there's a whole big plot there, let me tell you. And there's a whole big history of music and what goes on with getting your songs published and the music industry. You can learn an awful lot, let me tell you. It's not just about music. But my dad took us to he had a friend that was the vice president of Sam Goody's when I was younger. So he took us to the Apollo Theater when they had the Motown shows. If I was good and got straight A's, I got to go. Otherwise, forget it. And he took us once in a while to the Ed Sullivan show on Sunday. And it was hilarious because my father would have to pretend to be somebody else every time he went up to sell, you know, who the tickets were. And we had to remember who he was, actually. And I used to pray at him, Dad, but what happens if they call your name in the audience? Because Ed once in a while would say, who's in the audience? I said, you better hope that you didn't, you know, just say you went to the bathroom or something. So how much research did you do to write these, to write both novels?
Oh, it took a tremendous amount of research. Once I decided on the scope of the books and the time of the book and the time frame that I wanted to tell, because what I knew about the artists and the songs was a great help, but I had to go really way back and find out about what life was like down in the South in the mid-50s. The book begins in 1953 when my main protagonist is a young man serving in the military, getting ready to go to fight in the Korean War. And so I had to do, you know, find out what bases he might have been stationed at and what city and all of that. And it took a tremendous amount of research, but I found a lot of research, good research material and source mm-hmm. material to bring me back there. And then as I went along, you know, one thing led to another. The amazing thing about doing research on the internet, as you know, I'm sure, is mm-hmm. you'll come across a fact that'll take you to a link that'll take you to another fact, and it just steamrolls from there, and you come across, oh, that's got to be in the book. This fact has got to be in. Somehow you have to work this information into the book. So it was quite a journey. You're an author, you know, the research is the fun part, the writing is the fun part, and then marketing is the hard part, but that's basically what it was. So it took a tremendous amount of research, but it was fun. Had a great time doing it.
It is fun because people don't realize how much you can learn just by researching a book, and things that you never knew existed before, you really do learn. And that's the fun part, I know. When you want to do something. I know my magazine, I'm doing some research on autism because they were going to have a whole big thing on autism awareness in the next issue of the magazine. And what you can learn, just by, like you said, going to one link leads you to like 5 million. And then you have to pick out the ones you want. The good part is that, you know, you cite them in the bibliography, and that's fine. But when I did my Alzheimer's book, I had to call Alzheimer's to ask permission to use their stuff. You know, before they were allowed. Yeah, sometimes you do. So tell everybody about the Rabinowitz family and a little bit about.
Well, my protagonist's name is Joseph Rabinowitz, and at the beginning of the first book, as I said, he's a young man. He's a young teenager. He's a Jewish kid from the Bronx, from New York, from Manhattan, actually, and he's kind of got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. His his parents escaped Europe just as Hitler came to power. And he lost a great, great number of his relatives and friends in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And he's got this chip on his shoulder because he is Jewish. And he wants to do something to kind of fight back. So he ends up volunteering, enlisting in the army around 1953, just as the Korean War is raging. And he gets stationed down in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And he gets into the armored division. And there he meets another kid from the North by the name of Danny Cavelli, who was from Cleveland, Ohio. And they become friends, and they watch each other's backs as two Northern boys from the big city. And he becomes very, very friendly with him. Also, while he's down in the South, he has a chance meeting with an old Negro guitar player, R&B guitar player, and he becomes fascinated by the music this guitar player plays on his guitar. That his name is Chanticleer, and he becomes fascinated with the music, and he wants to learn all about it. And that's really the jumping off part, a point from the book where he learns all about it, and it just takes off from there. And eventually he gets to meet Janet Cavelli, who is the sister of Danny, and they fall in love, and they come to New York together, and he resolves himself to get some kind of job in the music industry, and that sets him on a life path that takes him through all three books, actually.
Actually, there are times I wanted to find the record so I could just put something on and play it on the show. I downloaded Paul Anka as my ringtone the other day, You Are My Destiny, because I love Paul Anka. And my niece called me, and she said, since when do you listen to that? I said, always. She said, well, you better get some rap on it or forget it. But I much rather have something like that than on my phone than the rap music, even though I listen to everything.
Oh, true. I mean, music.
I listen to anything.
Certainly have changed over the years, you know. But the youth of today is entitled to their music just as we were. The thing about the music that you and I are so much in love with is the fact that in the '50s is the first generation of kids that had their own music. Prior to that, you listened to the radio to what your parents listened to. But the technology that occurred in the 50s, the invention of the 45-inch vinyl record, and the invention of the transistor, where you could have your own radio and listen to the music that you wanted to instead of what mom and dad wanted to listen to. So we cultivated that whole generation cultivated a whole new type of music. And that's where rock and roll came from.
My dad had a friend that will in the store, the record store down the block, and they would monitor, of course, what I bought. But if I got all A's in school, I was allowed to have. I had the top 100 all the time, you know, in the vinyl.
Okay.
He did. I don't know. And my sister had them. I have no idea what happened to some of the records that I have. But yeah, I mean, we had the parties were in my living room, and I think I miss that. Even though there are CDs and DVDs and all of that, I miss the stereo where you had the little thing in the middle, and you put the records on how you wanted to play them, not how they have
exactly
them on
right,
the disc.
Yeah.
It was more fun. I mean, I'm not that old, but it was more fun back then because you got to pick what you wanted and play the songs that you wanted. So
exactly,
tell everybody
exactly
about who Dani is and her relationship to everything.
Well, Janet and Joseph get married, and they go through the era of the 50s, and Joseph forms a highly successful independent record label called Chanticleer Records. He named after his friend Chanticleer mm-hmm. from the South, and it became highly successful. And then, just prior to the British invasion, the pressure of the business and the pressure to succeed in the business causes a rift between him and Janet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, career just kind of helps their marriage to deteriorate and fall apart to the point where Janet decides to get to divorce Joseph. And she goes to England to write a coffee table book. She was always fascinated mm-hmm. with castles as a teenager, and we developed that in the book. And in England, she meets and falls in love with a British rock singer by the name of Ian Markham, who is forming his own little British invasion band. And they have a child out of wedlock that they name Danielle. And Danielle is Janet's daughter. And you don't want to give away too much of the book, but it comes to the point of fact that Janet returns to the United States. And she remarries Joseph, and Joseph adopts Dani as his daughter. And as the books go along, she gets older, and the torch is kind of in the second book, Beyond Vinyl, the torch of the music business is kind of passed on to Danielle.
This is so interesting, because just to get a record out there and get it produced, and then to know who to ask and who to trust. So tell everybody about the Duquesnes. You made the group up, right? They're not a real...
I did. The Duquesnes are a fictional vocal group from the Bronx. I tell the stories
in the best borough in the world. That's where I come from.
several different storylines, simultaneous storylines. And the Duquesnes are a vocal group from the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx. They live in the Throgs Neck Project.
Nice.
They live in the Throgs Neck Project just over the Whitestone Bridge. And that's where the story becomes a tad autobiographical, because that's where I grew up. I grew up in the Throgs Neck projects in the Bronx. And we didn't have a vocal group. We had a little band around the Beatle time. And the Duquesnes are formed by two friends, Johnny Saraceno and Bobby Vitale, and they form a little vocal group, and they get to be very, very good. And they get their first break with Chanticleer Records, Joseph's record label. And they go on there, and they become the biggest vocal group in the country, sort of a composite of Dion and the Belmonts and those groups. Mm. All my musical groups and performers are composites of real life groups and entertainers that performed in that era. I also have a black female trio called the Pixies, and they're sort of a composite of the Ronettes and Martha and the Vandellas and the Supremes. And a lot of my readers have a lot of fun. You know, they write me on Facebook, or they write me a note saying, "Oh, I know who that is. That's so and so. That's so and so." And there's also a young male singer by the name of Teddy Boyette, who comes out of the South from Chanticleer. Chanticleer is his mentor. And he becomes the first artist that Joseph signs. And he becomes the biggest rockabilly singer that there is. And he's a composite of Elvis Presley and Johnny Cochran and Buddy Holly and those guys. So, you know, that's the record label is formed with these artists, and it's all a composite of real-life people that performed, artists and groups. they all become part of the story and the framework of the narrative as it goes along.
We have a lot of people in the chat room here. Whoa. This is really
good. Hi, everybody in the chat room.
There's John Augustine, one of a really great author. There's Karen Vaughn, and I don't know who the other person is, but hi. And Karen is here, and I'm sure she's going to want to get in on the conversation. This is a book about the 50s and 60s, Karen, and if you want to review it, let me know, and I'll put you in touch with Donald, because you just actually could dance your way through the book. What can I say? Karen is one of the reviewers. She wrote some really great book reviews and articles for the magazine, too. For my magazine that came out last week, and she's a good reviewer. Otherwise, I wouldn't say.
Hi, Karen.
And she writes really good reviews. And everybody knows on my side, it has to be positive, or it's positively not going to get there.
Well, so, I certainly appreciate the reviews you did for both books. How extensive and how positive they were. It's wonderful to me to get that kind of feedback from prestigious people such as yourself.
Thank you, because I actually try to be really careful about no spoilers, and I know mine are detailed, but sometimes I your books are one thing, and then the last couple of books I've been reading, I was polite and just did summaries, because I don't like to pan a book, and it's been difficult. But for those people out there that want to know what I'm reading, well, before I ask Donald the next question, I'm finishing Silencing Eve, which is coming out October 1st, the last of the trilogy of Iris Johansson's book, When Eve Gets Taken, and that's all I'll say. You want to read it, people. It's good. Okay. So what strides in technology have happened during this time period that would change the sound of music?
Well, at that time, as I said, the invention of the transistor, which changed communications entirely, because now you were able to walk around with a little transistor radio in your pocket and listen to the kind of music that you wanted to. The technology that brought about the 7-inch vinyl 45 RPM record, the fact that that television back in the 50s kind of almost destroyed radio. All the radio shows, soap operas, game shows, Western shows and things like that were on the radio every night were all of a sudden on TV. So radio had to reinvent itself, and the way they did it was with popular music. They started playing popular music, the music of the time, so that now all of a sudden the radio was filled with songs and artists that people could listen to and then go out and buy the records. And then as years went by, certainly the 45 records turned into albums. Then they turned into cassettes, CDs. And now we've come really full circle. It's amazing. It started as 45s, one song or maybe two songs on a record. Then they became albums with 10 or 12 songs. Then they became cassettes that you could play in your car, and CDs that you could play at home. And now we're all the way back to MP3s, which is one song again, so we've come full circle.
I still like one song or two songs. There's just something about an album with so many songs, and you're looking for the one that you want, and it's in the middle of the album, or it's at
the last song.
Yeah, it's the last one, and then you have to pray that the line is there so that you could actually find it on the album. I know, because my dad said to me, "What albums do you want?" I go, "Just let me go into the store and get what I want." You know, my little 45. So my sister put her label, her name on the ones that were hers, and mine on the ones that were mine. Little Band-Aids.
Well, now you can go in, and now you're back to downloading one song per 99 cents. You can download just one song and put it on your MP3 player and walk around with thousands of them at a time. It's amazing.
I haven't gotten that far yet. No, I have
me
my
either
ringtone.
To tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But
I have
just,
my ringtones
I just,
on my phone. That's about it. So, who is your favorite artist? Your very favorite artist of that era.
I'm kind of I go back all that way, and I think about it. And as I said, I was a fan of the British Invasion. I was a Beatles fan, Dave Clark Five, Jerry and the Pacemakers. And then when I discovered Dion and the Belmonts, certainly loved Dion and the Belmonts, the Four Seasons, the girl groups, the Ronettes, and groups like that. And over the years, I've just enjoyed, a lot, up until about the mid-80s, I'd say. I went over to country music maybe in the mid-70s when I didn't enjoy the headbanging and a lot of those other groups. I kind of developed a liking for country for a while, and now I just kind of like the mellow sounds of a lot of these artists, and I've maintained a liking for a lot of the groups which have sustained themselves over the years and maintain, you know, the groups that still perform, like Jay and the Americans and guys like that, Bobby Rydell. Bobby Rydell was just in Loretto Park in the Bronx last night singing. Can you imagine?
Oh, my God. I love him.
And so it's really fun to follow all that. I do have a particular favorite that maybe you're not too familiar with, maybe your audience is not either, but there's a group called Kenny Vance and the Planetones. And they have a really unusual history. They've never had a hit record. But Kenny Vance, the gentleman who formed the group, was an original member of Jay and the Americans, the guys that sang Karamia and Come a Little Bit Closer and things like that. In the early 90s, Kenny formed a group called the Planetones. And they sing a lot of the old songs, but they give it their own unique flavor and a way of doing it. And they have now become the number one oldies group on the oldies circuit today. If you go onto YouTube, there's lots and lots of their stuff up there. And they're on the circuit. Kenny is, you know, a guy, he's in his late 60s. And they perform all over up and down the East Coast. They're here, they're there. Last week, one night they were in a Westbury Music Fair. Then they were in Atlantic City. So they're out and performing up and down as cruises along the East Coast, and they're just absolutely strong, and that's the kind of thing that I like, and it's spilling over to the youth. There's a group of young guys in Barcelona, Spain, called the Earth Angels, and they sing a lot of a cappella.
I love that song. That was my favorite song in the whole world, Johnny Tillotson and Earth Angels.
Earth Angel, there you go. And it's really refreshing to me when I see a young group like this that embrace that old type music. It's amazing. You know, thanks to T.J. Lubinsky and PBS, we see a lot of these shows. He puts together a lot of these shows. Law Entertainment out of New York brings these showcase shows around, and we get a few. I'm in the West Coast. I'm in Las Vegas, and we get a few shows like that in California. My wife and I are always traipsing around looking for these groups. Just this past month, we had some great shows. So Dion here in Las Vegas.
I love Dion.
The Brooklyn Bridge here in Las Vegas.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Without Johnny Maestro, though, yeah.
Yeah, Johnny Maestro passed away, and it was a little melancholy going to see them. But Joe Esposito, who was another member of the Planetones, and he sang with Donna Summer for a while, he's taken over the lead singing duties, and they're terrific. They really have reinvented themselves. And they're, you know, having a little renaissance back there. And it's good to see that, because the other members of the group are still talented guys. Johnny's not there anymore, neither is Fred Ferrara. But they still perform and they still sound great.
Those are my favorite group. Like I said, the music was great and you can actually understand the words. And
that's
could
for
actually
sure.
Get up and dance. I know, at my nephew.
Yeah, I mean,
book,
who writes, I mean,
who
the
writes
lyrics,
like that? Nobody. Nobody writes
lyrics,
like that anymore.
Who writes Rama? I have a girl named Rama Lama 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 Ding Dong. Nobody writes lyrics like that anymore.
No, but you know what? My favorite thing was at a point. I was a klutz. I'm still a klutz. So you know, when it came to inventing, you know, the peppermint twist and the twist and chubby checker, that was something I could do because you didn't have to move your feet too much. That was good.
That's right.
Or the locomotion wasn't bad. Or if the hustle, well, I had to remember all those steps. But my sister was really great at that. She was a good dancer. So that, and she always wanted to become a great dancer. She did dance in Broadway shows, and she did before she died, and she actually sang in some also. So and then there was me, the klutz. But I, you know, it didn't matter. I accompanied her on the piano, so it didn't matter. So tell us more about Ted Boyatt's son. Who is TJ, and why did he decide to ask Joseph for help? We're not telling you everything, people, because you want to read this book.
Well, actually, there's two. We don't introduce TJ into the second book, Beyond Vinyl. But, and again, not giving too much away, in the first book, Teddy Boyette is killed in a plane crash, much in the way that Buddy Holly was at the height of his career. And he had had an affair with a waitress while he was becoming famous in Kentucky. And being that he was gone, a lot of fans of mine from Facebook were shocked that I got rid of this character so early in the first book.
Too.
So I felt kind of guilty. And I said, you know, I got to find a way to bring his memory back, if not him personally. I did a couple of flashbacks, but I wanted a way to bring it back. So I developed this character of TJ, who comes forth as Teddy Boyette's illegitimate son. And he comes onto the scene, and he actually is at odds with Joseph because he feels that, you know, his father didn't recognize him and give him, you know, his name or anything else like that. So there's a lot of conflict between Joseph and TJ. And TJ is kind of abrasive at the beginning when we first meet him. Not really a very likable character. He's a young man. And again, you know, he doesn't cling to his heritage. But as time goes by and TJ falls into some problems, he realizes that the one real person that can help him is Joseph Rabinowitz. So he goes to Joseph for help, and wouldn't you know it, he meets Joseph's daughter, Danielle, and of course they fall in love.
That's all we're going to tell them. But you know what? What got me was that as I was reading this, you have so many landmarks that I know of where I used to live in the Bronx, because I moved from the Bronx. So you did Louis Pizza, and you did Joe and Joe's, and I'm like, I know those places. They're still there, by the way.
Well, probably, I don't know if it's something we should talk about on the air, but my dad worked in Louis Seafood. He was a bartender in Louis Seafood.
It's still there, and I looked it up.
It's still there. The family that owned it then does not own it. I worked in Louis Seafood with my dad when I was a kid. All three of my younger brothers worked there as kids.
Really?
So, when, you know, I wanted to give the book a sense of neighborhood. I wanted to give the book a locale and setting that I was familiar with and a lot of people could be familiar with. That neighborhood in the Bronx has so much in common with neighborhoods all over the city, in Queens, in Brooklyn, in Staten Island, you know. So anybody that has a good sense of neighborhood will feel at home in the setting of the Bronx where I put the book. And they find that, you know, wonderful. And I do, too. I think it's really great.
Yeah, you did, because you brought me back to where I came from. But
right, exactly.
Yeah, Dion and the Belmonts used to come to Arthur Avenue a lot. So, you know, once in a while we'd go there, and hopefully we could see them, you know, see them as they were passing through, because pretty much they were over there all the time also.
Well, but they lived there.
Yeah, they lived there. That's why we used to say, okay, we're going to go to Arthur Avenue, see, maybe we'll see Dion. We actually had concerts once in a while, so we got to see him. But like I said, my dad took us to all this other stuff, so I didn't get to see the Beatles, but we got to see Bobby Darin before he died, and a few others that were really, you know, that were great. So what are five important things in the music industry that made you feel that this time period was special? And what about the music industry that did people have to really be careful about when they were, you know, dealing with some of the producers and record people?
Well, they were all very innocent when they got together. All the groups were very interested. They were just kids in the street who happened to live in the same neighborhood, who maybe for just to keep out of trouble, got together on a street corner and started to sing. And learn how to sing and learn how to harmonize and do all of that. And then they were friends. They were friendly. They did this. They did it for fun. And then some of them were lucky enough to attract the attention of record companies or someone who with a business-minded intelligence who would put them together and try to manage them and introduce them to record company people and then sign a record contract and be promised the moon. And be promised this, that, and the other thing. And they would put out these records. And I'm sure none of them, when they were 15 or 16, thought that they'd be doing the same thing for the next 50 years. But some of them ended up doing that. And a lot of the managers and a lot of the record companies and a lot of the executives didn't treat them very well, didn't treat them very fairly. I know that guys like Phil Spector, record mm-hmm. promoters and producers. I know Phil Spector would pay the lead singer of the Crystals, instead of giving her money, bought her a poodle.
I remember that.
For having a number one record. Now, of course, he bought them cars, he bought them houses, he did all these things for them out of their royalty. So, I mean, he didn't exactly just cheat them, but they certainly never received the money or things like that. Spector made millions, all these other managers and record company executives made millions and millions of dollars. And certainly the groups didn't get that. So a lot of them felt very cheated by what happened. Cool. And, they just got a bad, taste in their mouth over that. I mean, and you're seeing it a lot today. If you look on the inside, insider's kind of perspective of it, a lot of these artists, there's a movie out now called 20 Feet from Stardom, where a lot of the gals who were backup singers, Darlene Love and a couple of others, talk about how, they were 20 feet, the singing background and not mm-hmm. being given the type of recognition that they should have. And here they are. I mean, Darlene Love, who sang with the Crystals in not recently, but in after her stardom, she ended up cleaning people's homes to keep herself afloat while she was going through some difficult times. So, they didn't all end up being huge superstars. And,
I've got a few questions for you from the chat room.
Okay.
Okay, we got John Augustine has a question. He wonders what your take will be on groups like the Beach Boys and the Stones.
Well, certainly two great groups. The Rolling Stones followed the Beatles here in the second wave of the British invasion. They were kind of the bad boys of rock and roll, while the mm-hmm. Beatles were the poster boys from rock and roll. And you can't argue with the Stones' longevity. They're still out there performing and doing concerts. The Beach Boys the same way. Three brothers and a cousin from California who had a great love for the harmonies of the Letterman and groups like that, and they had great harmony. And same thing with them. They signed on to with the Capitol Records, and they have a career that spanned the last 50 years. And and that brings up another question about a lot of these groups that now half of the groups don't talk to one another anymore. Mm. I mean, Mike Love, who was an original Beach Boy, certainly, and the cousin of the Wilson brothers, has been out there performing with Bruce Johnson and a bunch of other guys, and they put together the 50th anniversary tour with Brian Wilson, the last surviving member of the Wilson brothers, and Al Jardine, who was an original, a friend of them, and after the tour was over, he fired them both.
Mm.
So there's a lot of animosity that goes on between these guys. The Stones, I read a great autobiography. I read Keith Richards' autobiography called Life, and he talks about they only get together for shows. They know when they know where they have to be to do a certain show. They show up, they get together, they look at a list, they go on and they perform. That camaraderie that they had when they were young and growing up in the same area, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's become just, okay, show up, do the songs, and that's it. And that's a shame.
Someone was saying that yesterday on one of the news programs that NSYNC might get back together again, and they just said, well, maybe just, as friends or whatever, and they were hoping that they would perform again. That would be really great because I liked NSYNC, but I don't know. So what about DJs and radio stars? How much influence did somebody, my favorite one, was Cousin Brucey? And
Cousin Bruce is still around. He's on XM Sirius, and he's still around. He certainly was one. I can certainly remember Alan Freed, Murray the K, Don K. Reed from the Doo-Wop Shop on CBS FM, Norman Knight. And a lot of that was just in the New York area. I mean, there have been dozens of others around the country. But they were all going back to now Alan Freed, Alan Freed would end up with his name on records as a writer.
Mm.
And he never wrote a word of any of these songs. But that was just that thing. If you wanted Alan Freed to play your record, you had to give him credit on the record label. So that goes back to all the infighting. And then, mm-hmm. you know, the payola issue, which I addressed in the first book.
Yeah, you did.
But radio certainly was the way to do it. I mean, you had to have the DJs playing the songs on the radio two, three times an hour. I think I did one of the things I did in my first book was when Joseph Rabinowitz brings one of Teddy Boyette's songs to a local DJ. The DJ says, "Okay, we'll make it the pick hit of the week."
Mm-hmm.
And he plays it and he lies to the audience. He says, mm-hmm. "Oh, we got so much demand, we're going to play it again in the next 15 minutes." And he did, but there was no demand. But then it caught on. After a while, it caught on. The more times he played it, the more it finally caught on. And you know that's just the way it was done.
You have to be lucky. You have to get someone to actually give you a shot and want to listen. You know which show, of course, what the influence of American Bandstand was great too, right? I mean, Dick Clark did so much for new stars, didn't he?
Dick Clark was instrumental in all of that, and
yeah.
You know, he took over the show when it was local in Philadelphia. He took over for an MC who had I think he was arrested for a DUI, and they asked Dick Clark. Mm. To fill in and do the show for a while, and he became so successful at it, and then he took it national, and then he just, you know, it was his influence that got so many of those artists on, and actually took it to TV. The other guys that we talked about, Murray the K and Cousin Bruce, they just did it on the radio, but Dick Clark did it on television, and every day, kid, you know, I'm amazed. Women say we rushed home, we watched the show, we saw what the dancers were wearing, and we had to wear that, and we saw how their hairstyles looked, and we had to go and have our hair made up to look like that. So the influence that he had was amazing, and he became a mogul, an entertainment mogul, going into other TV shows and game shows. And he just became a mogul in entertainment, as I said. But so certainly,
yeah.
I mean, he is, you know, can be credited with all that. And I have a little instance in the second book where Janet and Danielle go down and meet Dick Clark at a New Year's Rocking Eve when Dick was doing that every New Year's Eve in Times Square.
I did go down there a couple of times, and I didn't see him because he was so far back, yeah. And I really wanted to go down when, you know, with Ryan Seacrest, but there's nobody around here that's brave enough to do that anymore. And it's fun. You have to do it once or twice just to get out of here.
Yeah, I guess, I did it once.
You haven't lived until you've gone to Times Square with 10,000 people. It is so it's so crazy. But if you don't do it at least once, one crazy thing in your life, forget it. And now I did it with a whole bunch of people that, you know, were just friends from college or whatever. And I graduated college. I was 18 and a half. So that was my little graduation present to myself, going downtown and doing something really wild. I don't know. So in book number, this is another question I just added. What influence did politics have on music back then? You know, in the war, the Vietnam War, in the 60s, and all of those. What influence did that have?
My goodness, the kids that we were introduced to in 7-inch vinyl,
mm-hmm.
who are in their early teens, were in their late teens when Vietnam came about, and the protest movement came about, and a lot of protest songs were written, and that was one of the things that happened. Those teenagers, I can take credit for it. I think we changed the world. We protested, mm-hmm. and the war, and we put out music. We put out protest music, and we marched and did all those things. We marched on Washington, and we did all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And we were instrumental in letting the government know that as young people, You know, we didn't like what was going on. That put us at odds, though, with the young folks, our people our age who were over there and doing the fighting. And that was a shame. That kind of caused a rift between the returning Vietnam veterans and the guys and gals who stayed home and protested the war. But we got by it, and that set the tone for everything that happened to music after that. Anytime there was anything we didn't like, we showed our dismay and our displeasure through music.
Do you think they do that now also?
I don't know if there is anymore. I think now I don't listen to a lot of what's out there now. I think what they're probably protesting is the plight of the inner city, which they always did, the plight of the inner city against the establishment. I don't think it's as worldwide as it was before, but one of the things, Fran, that has become, because of the introduction of the internet and the communication satellites and everything else and digital TV and satellite TV, the world has become such a small, small place that, you know, it's just amazing. Something happens in Iraq or Iran, we know about it 10 minutes later.
That's so very true. That's what's even scarier, that we know a lot about, and we can see it. Or somebody's filming a video, or somebody does a YouTube video or something like that.
Well, that's what happened with Vietnam. I mean, all of a sudden you'd be sitting at home with your family eating a TV dinner, watching Walter Cronkite and seeing body bags being loaded into helicopters. So that brought the war home, put it right into your living room, right into your lap. So certainly all of that had an effect on what was going on. And the music. It can't not. It certainly has to.
And are you going to do, in the next book, are you going to bring more about Woodstock and the 60s and that type of music, or are you going to get a little bit
Well, actually, the second book takes you up to 1986, so we're beyond Woodstock, and that in 86 was really the beginning of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And
that's
all of
how
that
you ended
and
this
the
one,
and,
yeah.
Right, and the Reagan era. So now we're going to go forward. The new book is called When Gold Turns to Gray, and it goes from that into the from 1987 through 2001, just after 9/11. So it's going to bring in the introduction of the internet and all of that, and the World Wide Web, and we're going to hand the baton to Danielle and TJ and a couple of other new characters who are going to carry it along. And I haven't decided yet on whether or not I want to do a fourth book.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do, because you have to get current here, and you have to.
I
got to
get current,
you know,
huh?
Yeah, you have
well,
to. I mean, according to my nephew,
I'll
he thinks
come
I'm cool
up with some new.
Because his aunt listens to his rap music when he puts it on in the car, and I dance with him, and we you know, and I start singing with him, which is a disaster. But you know, I listen to everything, so you're gonna have to get current. You have to have. I'll even tell you which artists you know you can even add you or add whatever. But
all right,
I think you have to.
I appreciate that.
Go on.
I was thinking about this as I'm about midway through the third book now, and kind of just a couple of months ago, I was contemplating, all right, what do? Do I finish it here or do I take it on? I mean, the characters that we did in the first book were in their teens. If I take it to a fourth book, they're going to be in their 60s or 70s. I mean, is the audience going to stay with folks that old? And I'm going back and forth. So what I actually did was write the last chapter of the fourth book in my head. And put it down and put it away deep in the bottom drawer of my desk. So that's already done. So if I can find something to fill up another 300 pages, I'll probably take it to the fourth book.
Well, if you send me the last chapter of the book, I could probably tell you how to fill up the other pages. That's what they told me that I'm pretty good at. But, you know, I just figured out what you could write for my magazine. For those of you that don't know, my magazine came out last week. MJ Magazine is for authors, writers, educators, and readers. Writing tips, articles on all sorts of things that have to do with a character analysis, setting, book reviews, and Karen Vaughan's reviews are in there. Mine are in there. Christoph Fischer's in there. John Land's in there. Steve Berry, there's a whole bunch of people. And there's a whole bunch of new people that are going to give us. So we're going to do a thing on autism and autism awareness for the next one. But I figured maybe you could do something on Where Are They Now? Some of the stars that you know about. And I think people love to know. People would love to know where Don K. Reed is now, or Cousin Brucie, or any of the other stars, or even the group that you told us about. Where are they now? And maybe people will want to look them up, and some links to them also. And then, of course, you could put the links to your books in the magazine. Since it's my magazine, I could do whatever I want.
Well, I'd certainly love to do that, but what I'm trying to do with Don K. Reed, I've met him a couple of times. I've been back east a couple of times to a weekend oldie show that Lar Entertainment puts on out in Hop Hog, Long Island, every April. It's a two-day show, 15 acts a day. It's fabulous. People come from all over the world to see this. And Don K. always shows up. And I want to write his autobiography. And he's given me such a hard time. And he's saying, nah, nobody cares about me. I was local. I'm saying, you're nuts. You have no idea the impact you had on so many people every Sunday night with that radio show, the Doo-Wop Shop. And I'm lobbying so hard, and I'm telling him, I want to do your autobiography. Let me do your autobiography. Nah. He's dragging his feet. So
tell
if you call Don K.
for
me.
Let me review it, and then we can do a show, and we can be on it.
There you go.
Just tell him, tell him he's got free publicity from me. Oh, my goodness.
Hang on 1 minute.
Okay.
RTV here gives you an alert when it's going to rain.
Oh, well, it's going to rain here, too, but they're not alerting me yet. Okay, that's almost as good as the music that somebody played last time on the show. Okay, Cable, that's enough. We heard you.
Okay, there you go. But, I'd love to do that. Certainly. Usually it's not even a rain thing. It's flash floods. That's what we have out here, flash floods. If it rains 50 miles north of here, the water rushes down and goes through and floods the streets, even though there's not cloud in the sky.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I would think that you should how do we get him to do this biography? That would be very interesting, because I like Don K. Reed. And you can tell him that he could be on my show. And I know Marcia Cook is listening. She'll want him on her show also. I can tell you that.
There you go.
And he's got two people that'll definitely talk about the 50s and the 60s. And I guarantee there's a whole bunch of people that will probably call in. But before I forget, next Thursday, I have New York Times bestselling author Peter Troy. May the road rise up to meet you. And let me tell you, my cousin's book club has told me that they're all going to tune in. All 25 of them.
Hey.
Yeah, well, we were talking, and she told me about the book, and Peter emailed me, would I read the book, and it's probably one of the best books about this, the history of Abraham Lincoln is in there, the Irish Revolution, the hunger, people coming to America, slavery, the Civil War, and a whole bunch of, it's a phenomenal book. Just get yourself a box of tissues while you're reading it, and it's really good. So before we close, you're going to write.
Well, I think what we've done is we've given your listeners a great, great preview of what's going on. So I'd like to let them know how they can get the books.
I was just going to ask you that. Where are your websites? And remind them of what's next, and let's make sure that they can know how to find you. And let's make sure you guys go on Amazon and all the other places to buy the book, because I said you should. Okay, go on.
Well, the book is available on Amazon.com in Kindle and print version. And the Kindle versions were one and two, number one and number two Kindle bestsellers back in May. They came in at number one and number two. So I'm very, very proud of that. And as I said, they're available in Kindle and print version. Now, I also have a website. And if you really, really want to have a hard copy of the book that's inscribed to you, here's how you get it. My website is www.doowopinthedesert, all one word. doowopinthedesert.com. And once you get to the website, you can enter the website, and there's a little jukebox on the website, and there are tabs on the jukebox, one for 7-inch vinyl, and one for Beyond Vinyl. And you go in there and you can order the book through there and write a little note on how you want it inscribed and where you want it sent. And you can mail me a check. There's an address there. Or you can use the PayPal link to order the books. And the third book is going to be called When Gold Turns to Gray, and I hope that everybody will enjoy these two books. I also have a huge following on Facebook, the Donald Riggio page on Facebook. We do rock and roll there 24/7, and people put up posts of songs and pictures and things like that. Someone just this morning, as I was telling Fran, sent me a link of Bobby Rydell singing a song at Loretto Park in the Bronx. So if you can get there and do that, we do 24/7. I have about 3,500 friends on Facebook. And that's the amazing thing about Facebook is that I have such a one-on-one relationship with my readers. They'll read the book and comment on it and give me ideas for the next one. And that's where we pick it up. I also would be remiss if I didn't mention Mike Miller, who is a radio personality in Florida, is a big supporter of my book. And he sang with a group called Harmony Street. And when the first book came out, and we were talking, he was asking me about the song titles that were in there because they're all fictitious. And he said, "Would you mind if I took a shot and wrote a song based on one of these songs?" And I thought, "Go ahead, take a shot." He wrote a song called "Bouncing a Kiss Off the Moon," which is a song that the Duquesnes, the fictional group, did in the book. And he recorded it. He sang all the parts himself, except for the bass part, which was done by Les Levine, who was a noted bass singer back in the Bronx. And it's up and it's available on it's on iTunes, available for 99 cents on iTunes. You can pick it up and listen to it, Bouncing Kiss Off the Moon, from the book. One of the members of my writers group out here is a student at Nevada State College, and she did a video on the song. That's up on YouTube. You can go to Bouncing a Kiss Off the Moon on YouTube and see this video that she put together. And that was shown at the Las Vegas Film Festival just last month. So, you know, we're all over the place. And the music, we keep the music alive. Fran and I are doing our best, aren't we?
Well, we are sort of doing our best. Of course, this is like one of my favorite time periods of music. Like I said, you know, you could dance. Everybody could dance. There were different types of music, slow, fast, whatever. And there was something for everyone. And they actually could understand the words to the songs. But maybe when you do the next book, we'll invite a couple of these people on. So maybe they want to sing some of this. So as a matter of fact, I have a friend named Irene Bronski. I haven't heard from her in a while. She wrote the biography of Johnny Maestro. And she had it
great,
published.
Irene is a great supporter of mine. She's on Facebook. She's a great Facebook friend.
Don't you love her?
Yeah, she wrote that stirring tribute to, Johnny.
And, I didn't realize that I should have emailed her, but she's been so busy. Last May, Irene got up and just after Johnny Maestro died, and she sang 16 Candles on my radio show. You had to be there.
Oh, boy.
It was good. No,
yeah, and
you had to be there. And she said to me, "Why are you letting me do this?" I said, "Because I think it would be fun." And then for the New Year's Eve, right before that, she sang "Auld Lang Syne," and we just all had so much fun. You know, you never know, but we thought it was hilarious. And she actually sang 16 Candles," and she said, "You're going to let me do it." I go, "If you're brave enough to do it with 1,000 people listening, I'm brave enough to let you get up there and do it." Of course, I was a music major, and I can play the violin and the piano, and the voice teacher said, "I will give you 6 credits not to sing, sweetheart. You know, I have perfect pitch in my head, but that's about where it is." So I want to thank you so very much. This was
I had a great time. You know, the time went so quickly, and it's a pleasure to talk to you and your audience, and I hope we kept the people in the chat room entertained, and I'll be more than happy to give you whatever you want for your magazine.
Yes, please email it to me whenever you have it. And when is the next book coming out, so I know when I'm going to get rid of the 30 that are inside that I have to read and I have time for yours?
You're going to have plenty of time to get rid of the 30. I'm kind of taking my time with this one. Hopefully I'll have it ready for the spring, next spring. And because I want, when I go back to New York, when I get back to New York, maybe next April, maybe I'll come out to that show in Hop Hog.
oh, just tell me it's not that far away. And you know what? Maybe I can get my husband to drive over the bridge. My sister
there you
lived
go.
In Wood, my sister died last year, and she lived in Woodbury. So we would go, you know, ever so often, we went to see, when we saw Paul Anka there, I was like, oh, Paul Anka, I love Paul Anka. And the lady that owned the bungalow colony where I went to, which we have our own thing on Facebook, Breezy Corners, was Neil Sedaka's nephew, with aunt. So, I mean, I never got to see him, unfortunately. What can I say? But I want to thank you so much.
Did you have one more? I have one more question for you. Did you ever go to see Paul Anka when he was in Freedomland?
No. As a matter of fact, I went to Freedomland and I was afraid. I went on the rides and I was so brave. And if the ride went more than 1 mile an hour, forget it. I wasn't going on it. But my father said that he did teach me how to do stock car racing. I don't think my mother ever knew that I did that. But to drive a car, it was, well, I don't drive because I was in a car accident and I have no peripheral vision. It's bad. So I can't tell distance. But when I did drive, if there was a cute guy coming on the road, that's where the car went. So forget it. No, I'm serious. The car would just automatically
typical
go
ponytail
wherever.
Teenager.
Yeah. And
well, thank you again, Fran. I had a great, great time.
You're welcome. And thank you so much. And thank you, everybody. And, John, I will email you with the answer to that question because I would like him to be part of the magazine because he's a really great author. And I know he's going to write, you know, he wants to be part of it also. And I want to thank you so much. And good night, everybody. Have a nice night.
Take care, Fran.